Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Anne McCutcheon, biographer of Florida writer Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings.
That is what she was looking for, what she noticed when she was there, how people, place, soil, plants, weather, it's all connected.
We'll discuss the interstate highway system and the town of Stark.
Stark, like other small towns, soon realized that vacationers were more interested in getting to their destination as quickly as possible than seeing the sights along the back roads.
And we'll talk about Miami fashion writer Joan Nielsen McHale. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings lived and worked in rural Florida near Gainesville. She wrote about her experiences in books including the 1939 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Yearling and the popular Cross Creek. Anne McCutcheon is author of the book The Life She Wished to Live, a biography of Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings published by W.W. Norton & Company. Like many people, McCutcheon discovered Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings' work as a child.
In the fourth grade in Pompano Beach, McNabb Elementary School, my fourth grade teacher read The Yearling to the class over the course of months, I suppose, because she read a few pages every day after lunch. We would come back from lunch and she'd read The Yearling to us. So that was my first exposure.
McCutcheon is a frequent visitor to Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings' farmhouse, which is now preserved in a state park at Cross Creek. McCutcheon says that visiting the property makes her feel closer to Marjorie.
Over the course of the research, I went to the farm many, many times. As you know, I attended Titusville High School, and one of my high school classmates has a lake house in Keystone Heights, which is not far from Gainesville and the creek. And so very often when I went to Gainesville for research, I'd also go out to Keystone Heights, and either Sandy would be there or I would have the house to myself. So I went to the creek every time, and I've taken the tour many times and taken friends on the tour. And then we often end up at the Yearling restaurant afterwards. So that was a way to introduce others to it. But being there by myself or just with a small group of people, I increasingly felt closer to Marjorie and the life she lived there. It has been beautiful, all of it.
Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings was a gifted writer. She was also an alcoholic who could be difficult to get along with. Anne McCutcheon wanted to find out more about this complex woman and discovered the extensive collection of Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings' papers at the University of Florida.
When I first called Flo Turcotte, who is the archivist in charge of the collection, I called her on the phone and said I was interested in coming to see the materials. She just shot back, it's one-stop shopping here. And she was so right. I mean, there were other things I had to research and to go dig out, but there was so much material there. One could simply write the biography from those materials. I found more, but still, it was massive. And when I first saw it all, I was overjoyed because there would be so much to work with. It didn't bother me at all that it would take time and effort. It was a treasure trove.
Rawlings was a prolific letter writer who corresponded with her agent, Max Perkins, both of her husbands, and fellow writers, including Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Zora Neale Hurston.
Well, thousands of letters, literally more than 4,000 letters to and from her. And so with that much material and many letters, I could get a sense, especially with her, the people she kept in contact with on a regular basis, of ongoing, unfurling, developing friendships and the kinds of things she shared ranged from how her ducks and petunias are doing, you know, in the spring, to what she's reading, conversations about books she had read and she and her correspondent had read. That was actually a hard part for me to slim down. I got engrossed at one point with everything she had read, and I was riveted by these conversations. But then I realized, you can't put every book in there. And some of these books are unfamiliar to people now. So that was a challenge for me. But that's all to say that the range of subjects was very broad. And she was just as excited about, spring vegetables emerging as she was about reading another political book around World War II.
Anne McCutcheon also turned to Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings' autobiographical manuscripts for insight while writing the biography, The Life She Wished to Live.
The one that she left behind, Blood of My Blood, which Anne Blythe edited and was published by the University of Florida Press, was essential to me. I put that together with information I got from a historian in Brooklyn, where she grew up, who could help me verify times and places and look at her book and say, well, what can we say is fact? Because she wrote it supposedly as a novel, or she tried to pass it off as a novel in a contest, but it is a memoir, and it's got a particular edge to it, coming to terms with her mother, so that has to be figured in. It's very challenging to look at something someone has written about their life and detect what the need of the document is, why she wrote that, what was driving it, and then from that to extract what could be fact or what was a real driver for this individual that is worth depending on and reporting in a biography.
Rawlings' Cross Creek is a semi-autobiographical book about her life in Florida and also informed McCutcheon's work.
It certainly did. There were a couple of stories from that, like Hyacinth Drift, which we, you know, so many of us love, that was an account of a trip she took down or up the St. John's River with Jesse Smith. And it's a gorgeous piece. But I also contrasted that with an interview someone had done with Jesse years later about that trip. And so I had Marjorie's lyrical, well-organized voice and some comments by Desi to put together and to refine the account of that trip. But Cross Creek is just a wonderful book of creative nonfiction, as we say, personal essays, personal episodes that ring with truth.
Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings didn't come from rural Florida, but immersed herself in the cracker culture she wrote about. This fit in with larger literary and journalistic trends of the period to preserve American folk culture. Anne McCutcheon.
She was writing at a time, the 30s and early 40s, about that particular place, rural Florida, which had not been documented in literature so much. WPA writers were going down into all nooks and crannies of the South, and some of them very wonderful writers being assigned or earning their living that way. But there was a move afoot after World War I to seek out the creeks and hollers that hadn't been exposed and to gather that culture. The Library of Congress was involved. So she was part of a trend, a movement even. But nowhere did I see in her correspondence anything about that. She never said in writing anywhere I could find, I'm going to join this movement, or I mean to wring stuff out of that place. I mean, nothing that spoke of a journalist or a culture historian going into that place. I only saw the need to write literature. So it's interesting, but she was of the time. She was of the times.
Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings did express racist views typical of the 1930s and 40s, her friendship with fellow writer Zora Neale Hurston expanded her thinking and helped her to grow in that regard.
It certainly did. She held the conventional views of the time, of white views of the time. I wouldn't call her a Southerner exactly. She wasn't really a Southerner. She sort of became one, kind of. But she held conventional views. She had a staff of African-American neighbors who helped on the farm and even served her breakfast in bed on occasion. So when she met Zora, it was what I like to say, the come to Jesus moment. We said, oh, here is a person of color who is a fabulous writer. She is my intellectual equal. Oh, and so the sky opened up for her, that friendship. And it took a couple of years. I sort of tracked it through correspondence with her husband, Norton Baskin, of how she gradually came to see what her views had been and what they needed to shift to. And she became an outspoken supporter of civil rights. It was a wonderful friendship, wonderful moment in her life.
Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings' writing demonstrates a cosmic consciousness that was built upon at Cross Creek.
It was an idea that she had encountered as a college student, and that phrase had just been invented maybe 10 years before she went to the University of Wisconsin and was applied to Whitman, for example. And it really fit her. She was not religious in a conventional sense, although she attended church as a child. But she latched onto that idea in college and wrote a college essay about it. There's a fragment of that essay that I was able to dig up. And so from that point, age 18, 19, she began to see more and more how everything is connected, everything, life on Earth, even things that aren't living on Earth are somehow connected to one another. And that idea she carried to Cross Creek. And that is what she was looking for, or what she noticed when she was there, how people, place, soil, plants, weather, it's all connected. And the idea of that web runs throughout all of her work.
Anne McCutcheon is author of the book, The Life She Wished to Live, a biography of Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, published by W.W. Norton & Company. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online to watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, find engaging educational resources, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the transportation systems of Florida have been critical to the state's economic development, but transportation history is not always factored into our understanding of the past.
You're right. 19th century Florida's economic history was defined by the railroads, and the 20th century by the construction of highways. As a PhD student at William & Mary College, Evan Bennett, now an associate professor at Florida Atlantic University, published an article in the spring 2000 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly, in which he used the town of Stark as a case study of the effects of highway development on a rural community economy. Founded in the 1850s, Stark was named for Governor Madison Stark Perry. It is the seat of government for Bradley County. In 1858, the Fernandina to Cedar Key Railroad reached Stark and contributed to its antebellum economic development. In the 20th century, state and federal government played a large part in the town's history, as Stark is located between Rayford Prison, 13 miles away, and Camp Blanding, 9 miles away. Rayford Prison houses state prisoners and is the site of death row and state executions. During World War II, Camp Blanding served as a training base for tens of thousands of soldiers, housed German prisoners of war, and was the site of one of the largest military hospitals in the country. Located in the state's northern interior, Stark and Bradley County have a complex history of rural isolation and agricultural production. First citrus, then following the 1894-95 freeze, strawberries, cotton, and corn. What we might characterize as a typical settler economic history was challenged in the 20th century by institutional development dependent on state and national objectives and funding.
Connie, the end of World War II brought enormous economic change to the entire state. We usually focus on the major cities as bellwethers of that change. How does our perspective change by looking at a small town like Stark?
In the post-World War II era, agriculture played a declining role in the town's economy, as Stark, like the rest of Florida, looked to tourism for its future. In the case of Stark, far removed from beaches that brought vacationers to the state, its location on U.S. 301, a highway that began in Baltimore and ended in Sarasota, made it a logical overnight stop for travelers. As the largest town between Jacksonville and Ocala, Stark boosters worked to make the city an attractive stopover with several motels, restaurants, and service stations. Widening of the highway and beautification of the road added to the town's charm. With four motels operating already, Holiday Inn came to Stark in the 1960s and added another 100 rooms. Town leaders predicted the arrival of the national chain would vastly step up the number of tourists. Traffic statistics on what was known regionally as the Highway of Southern Hospitality seemed to support the optimistic view. At Waldo, a town south of Stark, daily traffic volume on U.S. 301 increased from 1,859 per day in 1946 to 3,485 in 1951. By 1959, the number of cars had jumped to 6,832 per day. The New York Times noted the increased traffic and reported from Ocala that Florida's mid-state routes were becoming more popular with people driving down here from the north. Stark leaders did not rely solely on tourism for their city's future. Calling Bradley County Florida's four-season county, they mounted an aggressive campaign that included a 13-minute film to entice industry to the area. Among the advantages Stark leaders hoped to exploit was the city's status as debt-free, with no ad valorem taxes, and a reputation for providing all the modern services for urban life. In 1951, the first textile mill opened in Stark. Between 1956 and 1969, 16 plants opened or expanded in Stark. Both population and salaries grew, creating a housing boom that added 1,328 homes.
Connie, all that sounds very exciting, but there's a rest of the story that is not so promising, right?
That's true. The first hints of what was to come occurred during the 1952 gubernatorial election, when candidate Dan McCarty placed a full-page ad in the Bradley County Telegraph, condemning his opponent for his support of the proposed construction of four-lane expressways throughout Florida that would bypass Stark and Bradley County. The proposal died, but support for the expressways highlighted the emerging urban-rural battle between Florida cities and the so-called pork chop gang that controlled state government. If Florida cities had big plans, so did the federal government, and in 1956, Congress enacted the Federal Highway Act that produced the Limited Access Interstate Highway System. By 1970, Florida had four interstate highways: I-10 that ran from Jacksonville to Los Angeles, I-75 from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan to the Miami area, I-95, Maine to Miami, and I-4, an intrastate highway that connects I-95 and I-75 from Daytona to Tampa. Initially reassured that tourists would still take the scenic route, Stark, like other small towns, soon realized that vacationers were more interested in getting to their destination as quickly as possible than seeing the sights along the back roads. Towns without access to the interstate highways, like earlier towns without a rail line, witnessed a decline in their economy. As Bennett notes, at the turn of the century, quote, Stark is not a ghost town, but neither has it become a booming metropolis. After a decline in traffic in the 1970s, it now carries more traffic than ever, but few travelers stay overnight in the small town. Most drivers are passing between I-75 and I-95 and do not stop. Interstates transformed the American urban life, increasing the population and physical size of cities like Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, and Miami, and simultaneously reduced the prospects of so many small towns like Stark, who entertained such high hopes in the early post-World War II years.
And of course, as you noted at the beginning, Stark is now best known as the town next to Rayford State Prison, home of Old Sparky, and the site of Camp Landing. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Miami is a place that influences fashion. As Holly Baker reports, Joan Nielsen-McHale made a career of writing about fashion in Miami.
Dr. Kimberly Voss is a tenured professor of journalism at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. She's also the author of several books, including Reevaluating Women's Page Journalism in the Post-World War II Era, Celebrating Soft News. She told me about Joan Nielsen-McHale, the influential Miami News fashion editor who was known as Miami's first lady of fashion in the 1950s and 1960s.
Joan was a real pioneer in terms of early society writing. She was a great fashion editor, and she was one of the few women of her era in Miami to balance having a family with her career as a women's page journalist. She had four children. Most of the women's page journalists of that era had none. So she really was doing something that she didn't have a model for. She was really kind of trying to balance all these things on her own without the things that we have today, like childcare and that sort of thing. Joan was raised during the Great Depression. She had polio as a child. She began to get interested in journalism in high school and started writing society news for the Miami Daily News at age 15.
Before the 1970s, the only place where women like Joan Nielsen-McHale could work in the newspaper was the women's page. In the early 20th century, the women's page mostly covered society and fashion news. In the 1950s and 1960s, the women's section of the newspaper began discussing not only soft news, but also hard news topics, such as equal rights and reproductive issues.
Quite often during this era in the 1950s going into the 1960s, women couldn't work anywhere else in the newspaper on the editorial side. They could do classifieds and answer phones, of course, but to be in the women's page was sometimes seen as lesser, but women like Joan were significant to their communities and significant in what's called soft news, family, fashion, food, and furnishings. She had a noon to two daily talk show on WKAT. So she was multitasking early. So she did radio and she did print news. She went to the University of Miami, where she was voted class clown. She had that kind of personality, and you can kind of see that in her writing and in her friendships. She dropped out in 1953 to go into journalism. She had been the newspaper editor at the University of Miami, and she said in her later years, everything she really learned about journalism, she learned at the student newspaper, which I think could be said for lots of folks that have gone through student newspaper work in college.
As consumer culture emerged in the 1950s and 1960s, fashion journalists working for newspapers like the Miami News and the Miami Herald became very influential. Fashionable readers looked to Joan Nielsen-McHale for the latest clothing trends. She also became known for her society column about ordinary people.
When she was at the Miami News, she did have a kind of a neighborhood column. The neighborhood column would say, this is what your neighbors are doing. This is where so-and-so got accepted to college. This is where people are vacationing. or the kinds of things they did in their everyday lives. And historically, I think that's going to end up being very important. And many newspapers had that. And that was Joan's beat for a while, to write about what everyday people were doing, not just society parties or fundraising balls and that sort of thing, but just everyday people. And I think that's the thing that she's truly added to South Florida history, as well as the fact that the things she did at Women's Wear Daily, I think are going to be studied by fashion journalists and fashion historians in years to come.
Even though her column for Miami News often focused on everyday people, Joan Neilson McHale also had the opportunity to cover the most famous family of the time, the Kennedys, for Women's Wear Daily.
After she left Miami, she went to Women's Wear Daily, which is a nationwide newspaper devoted to fashion. And again, fashion is a significant industry in this country, even though we sometimes dismiss it as fluff or kind of lesser than hard news. But she covered fashion at Women's Wear Daily for many years, and one of her main beats was the White House. So she had a White House press card in the same way that Helen Thomas did. In fact, they worked there at the same time. But it was Joan's job to cover fashion at a time when the White House was very fashionable. This is the Jackie Kennedy years, as well as the fact that John F. Kennedy's sisters were also very fashionable. They don't always get the credit. And so she covered the inauguration. Describing what everyone was wearing was news. And we still see this to this day, who the designer is, what kind of coat the first lady is wearing, what other celebrities that are at the inauguration. So she got as much coverage for her work that was then often picked up at other newspapers across the country as a political writer. In 1961, she covered President Kennedy's State of the Union address. She also noted in her coverage that the president's sister, Ethel Kennedy, was hatless. Now, that doesn't seem like it would be news today, but Ethel not wearing a hat at this formal event was considered a big deal. And the Kennedys and hats are also part of fashion history. President Kennedy was known as the person that stopped men from wearing hats in our country. And again, you know, whether you like hats or don't, it's still a moment in history. And presidents after Kennedy still sometimes had to defend not wearing hats, but the Kennedys had a real change about that moment.
Joan Neilson McHale's fashion news reporting helped put Miami on the map as a trendy and stylish city. From being the fashion editor for the Miami News to reporting on the fashion of the Kennedy family at the White House during the peak of their popularity, she left her mark on women's news. Dr. Kimberly Voss.
Women like Joan made a difference in their community. They helped connect people to each other. They helped establish communities, especially when Miami was just kind of finding its footing in terms of a growing city. And she was the kind of person that helped change women's news. And since that was the one place that women could work at the time, that challenge to what women were interested in the newspaper was so important. And we see that in later years as we start to understand that women's interests were both inside the home and outside the home.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.